Good morning, Luke chapter number 6. I want to say thank you to all the instrumentalists and singers. What a great time of praising the Lord. Aren't you thankful for those great truths we sang about? You can have confidence, even if you don't have clarity in an uncertain world, because of who Jesus is and our hope resting in Him. Luke chapter number 6 is where we are at this morning. Luke is in the New Testament. So if you have a paper copy of God's Word and you open it to the middle, you'll come across like Psalm, Proverbs, and whatnot. Keep going to the right, you'll come across Matthew, Mark, Luke, or you can just Google Luke chapter number 6. Luke chapter number 6 as we go back to our series, Every Day with Jesus. So thankful to be back with you. I appreciate your prayers for myself and Brother Tyler as we were there at Boston Baptist College. I appreciate your willingness to let us go and be there and be a blessing and a help and invest in the next generation. And so we're thankful for that. And I miss being here. I was glad to be able to assemble last week in New England and hear a message on the love of God. But I'm glad to be back here with you today as well. Luke chapter number 6. I want to read to you verses 17 through 20. You follow along there and see right from the Bible what God has to say to you and I today. So Luke chapter 6, verse 17, Luke records this. And Jesus came down with them and stood in the plain, and the company of his disciples, and a great multitude of people out of all Judea and Jerusalem, and from the sea coast of Tyre and Sidon, which came to hear him, and to be healed of their diseases. And they that were vexed with unclean spirits, and they were healed. And the whole multitude sought to touch Jesus, for there went virtue out of him and healed them all. And Jesus lifted up his eyes on his disciples and said, "Blessed be ye poor, for yours is the kingdom of God." Have you ever watched a show or read a book? And they kind of throw you into a world that's unlike the world we live in and how it functions, how it operates. Maybe in this show or book, maybe the directions are different. North and south, east and west, or up and down, or are backwards or called different things. Maybe physics operate differently. Maybe you look up in the sky and there's different planets and whatnot and stars. You go around, you see in these worlds or reading these books, people who eat differently, communicate differently, just live all together different. It's just so unlike what you're accustomed to. I remember growing up as a kid watching a cartoon, and it introduced a world where Superman was the villain and Lex Luthor was the hero. Now, anybody who's ever had any exposure to Superman knows what. He goes around and is blue and is red, and he's kind of the hero. But in this world, it's kind of a bizarro world. Superman was the dictator. He was merciless. He was cruel. He was angry all the time. And Lex Luthor, his arch nemesis in what's the normal word, was actually the one leading rebellion against him to try to free humanity from his tyrannical clutches. And as a kid, I can remember thinking, that's not how this works. Superman's the good guy, right? Everything inside you is like, this is not the way this is supposed to function. And the story before told us how things happen, and now they're trying to present this weird world, and that's not normal. You might say, what does that have to do with Luke chapter 6? Well, this morning we begin a section in Luke's gospel where Jesus will unveil to his followers what his kingdom is like and how his followers function in his kingdom. And my point with that illustration is, from the outset and along the way, the hearers of Jesus' message are going to be just kind of like stunned. That's not right. That's not what we do. That's not how we respond. That's not how we function. That's not how we operate. You've got it all wrong. This is how we have to live. This is how we've been taught to live. And even you and I, as we'll go through this passage together over the next several weeks, we're going to read it, we're going to listen to it, and we're going to be prone inside to want to push back and say, that's cute, but that's not real life. That's fine, but that's not how I was raised. If I do that, I'm going to get trampled in my marriage. If I act that way at the workplace, I'm going to be eviscerated. No, Jesus, that's not how this world works. And I would just say to you and I, Jesus would look back at you and say, you're right. That's the problem. You're right. It doesn't function that way, but I'm calling you to a different plane and a different way of living that transcends what is normal to you and to me.
So as we journey through these passages together over the next several weeks, I'm asking you to join with me in reevaluating what we think we really know about Jesus and his instructions to you and I as his followers, and let him be our instructor about what is really true. Leading up to this section, we've seen Jesus confront the religious leaders and how they get everything wrong through their practice of religion and valuing rules and traditions rather than what God has called us to in relationship through faith. Now, here, Luke is showing us the selection of the 12 and the healing of those who had come to Jesus to show Jesus has a purpose and plan. He selects 12 who are not who we would choose, and he trains them and is patient with them and utilizes them, not because of what they brought to the table, but because what he would do through their life. And last time we talked about that. God works through us uniquely and purposely for his glory, and you are a somebody to him. And so Jesus is healing individuals. He's setting them free. And now we move to a portion that if you maybe have background in church, you're familiar with, particularly in Matthew's gospel. In Matthew's gospel, it's called sometimes the Sermon on the Mount, chapters 5 through 7. It has several here in Luke of the same elements, but Luke has a bit more of an abbreviated form, and the content's a little bit different. And it's called often, historically, the Sermon on the Plain. It has the same truths or messages presented that Jesus has been speaking of, and he's offering here his earthly kingdom to the Jewish people. He is their Messiah, and he's saying, if you will accept me now, I would set up my kingdom that has been long promised even now, which is in contrast to what the Pharisees and Sadducees had said. Here in our passage, over the next few weeks, we're going to see Jesus outlining the blessings of being in his kingdom. He outlines the blessings of being in his kingdom, but then he makes it clear. There's woes for being in opposition to him, verses 20 through 26. He counterculturally speaks about loving your enemies, and they had many enemies that they did not want to love and felt justified in hating, and Jesus flips that on its head as well. He speaks of judging your fellow human beings in verses 37 through 42, and then the proof of who he is and who is not his follower as he concludes the Sermon on the Plain. So verses 17 through 19 give us kind of the setting, and it gives us the audience that he's going to present these teachings to. We've seen this before, but look on the pictures here to get an idea. This is kind of the scene Jesus is likely presenting this message of. This is just west of the Lake of Galilee. So if this is Israel and this is the Lake of Galilee, he's on the west side here, kind of on these slopes somewhere. We don't know where, but he's speaking, he's teaching, using the natural amplification there. And crowds are gathered to be healed, and to hear his teaching, to see the words and the works of Jesus of Nazareth. It's a mixture here of men and women, and some perhaps familiar in that crowd with the rabbinical teachings of their day, maybe heard the Old Testament in their synagogues, the places where they had assembled to hear teaching instruction from the Old Testament. And maybe they had heard some things from the Pharisees, the religious leaders around them. And perhaps some of the crowd are completely ignorant. They're just excitement. There's this fellow named Jesus. He's doing a lot of neat stuff. Stuff we've never seen, teachings we've never heard, and we're going to go and watch and listen to him. So in this setting, Jesus begins teaching on his kingdom and teaching what his followers are like. And he starts off this monumental sermon, a sermon we think he preached multiple times and multiple ways throughout his ministry to multiple crowds. Jesus teaches them that before you can understand anything about him and his economy, before you make any progress, before you have any assurances and clarity, you have to start off with your understanding of your dependency, of your neediness, of what it is to be his follower. And so the reality I want you to consider this morning as we walk through our verse is this: you'll never know the blessings of salvation if you do not accept your inability to procure it on your own. So get it. It's like there's this vault, and it's filled with everything you could ever need or want and be helped by, but there's only one way in, friend, and you don't have the combo. You don't have it on your own. It's not yours. You don't have the ownership. You don't have the right. You will never enjoy the riches of who Jesus is and what he is offering in salvation, through salvation, and because of salvation, his deliverance, until you first recognize you have an inability to procure this on your own. So to this crowd, Jesus starts in verse number 20, his sermon. And he says, "Blessed are ye poor." Jesus is offering them, and frankly, every hearer or reader since, the opportunity of a blessed life. Now, it's important immediately that we start defining what Jesus means by a blessed life. That word gets used a lot, doesn't it? By all sorts of people from all sorts of background. Hashtag blessed, right? Blessed. What is it? Or blessed. We're prone to insert our own presupposition of what Jesus may mean when he says he's saying somebody can be blessed. And frankly, that's what human counterparts have been doing since time began, right? Well, the word for blessed in English is maybe something that we would attribute to or associate with the word happiness or the idea happiness. That's the etymology of the word or the definitional type of the word happiness. So this is just not happiness, though. Happiness is anchored to or tethered or defined or scoped by temporal longings. Temporal longings that are moored to our limited point of view and our frail desires. It's not tethered exclusively to our circumstances like earthly happiness is, the blessed life Jesus is offering. You and I, our idea of happiness is usually at best frail and self-centered. Let me try to illustrate it. The other week, I was working on a sermon at a coffee shop. I'd gone in. It's super packed. It's busy. It's one I've been to in Boston before. I like going there, Cafe Nero. And man, I was just really craving. It was a little cold. I was craving a nice hot cup of light roast black coffee. And they usually have pretty good coffee. So I go in, I offer it, and I notice the turkey goes to the wrong canister entirely. And you know how she cared about it? This much. So he gives me the wrong cup of coffee. I'm like, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe they labeled it backwards today. Let's just wait. You know, let's have some humility, Paul, and wait. So I go, I get my laptop set up, I put my headphones on, I open up everything, I start to study, and I go to take a sip, and it's not light roast. It's an ashtray of dark roast coffee. Blech. The only thing worse, guess what? It was semi-warm. Like the worst. I'd rather it be cold, I'll just drink it, or hot, and I'll have to wait, but don't give me the middle, right? So I end up with this. Let me just tell you, it's not the good way to start the sermon prep, right? That is not a happy situation. But that's how we are, right? Happiness for us is so frail and so fickle and so dependent upon people doing what we want and expect them to do when we want and expect them to do this. So is this the happiness Jesus is offering? It can't be. If he's the great Messiah, the messenger, the healer, the deliverer, he surely has to be offering greater happiness than something as pathetic and fickle as my coffee letdown would be. As with so many institutions and ideas, Jesus has his own definition and version based upon how heaven's economy operates. Catch this. Happiness, or the blessed life in Jesus' definition or understanding in its philology. That's the way the word is used. The philology in the New Testament is this, as one author said. It refers to the distinctive religious practice or religious joy which accrues to a man from his share in the salvation of the kingdom of God. So when Jesus is saying, blessed are you, blessed is, he's not saying it best based on our definition. He's basing it on his idea of you and I knowing what it is to be in his kingdom and enjoy his blessings, having gotten them by submitting to what he has said is necessary to receive them. So what is this very first blessing, this enjoyment, this wonder that Jesus is offering? He says, blessed are the poor. Now we hear that, and it's a contradiction and in need of defining as well as the word blessed. Though many in his crowd would no doubt have been impoverished during their time, the religious leaders around them had taught that if you experienced misfortune, or you had experienced some kind of poverty or some kind of hardship, well, that was your misfortune from God as retribution against your sinful choices by you or somebody else. So you pour, that's because of your sin or the sin of somebody close to you. So for them to right out the gate hear Jesus, the great Messiah healer, say, "Blessed are the poor," would be contradictory to all they had been instructed by the Pharisees about, the religious leaders of their time, and contrary to what they had believed culturally God would do as well. Remember, the Jewish people had been brought up in a common idea that sadly still resonates in humanity today, that if we do good, God's favorable to us. And he's favorable by your definition of favoritism. So if you're doing good and things are going well in your life, it's because you've done good by God's idea and your idea of it. But if we don't do good, what happens? Well, then God doesn't act favorably towards us by what we call favoritism or enjoyment. Listen, this idea is as old as humanity itself. Even Job and his friends, right? They come to comfort him, and the only message they have eventually is, "Hey, we're here to comfort you, but why don't you tell the truth about what you really did? You did something, otherwise God wouldn't be doing this to you." And Job says, "Oh, that's not the case." And they're like, "Oh, all right, okay. But seriously now, it's time to confess. What did you do?" This idea has plagued humanity because we have this idea that we think we can do things to change, curry God's favor, leverage God. This idea is as old as humanity, right? In our world, it goes like this. Bad things don't happen to what? Good people. But friends, that is about as dumb, asinine, and backwards as it comes in Jesus' economy. Because you know how many good people there are in Jesus' economy? That'd be a big zero. Well, that's why I don't like church and Christianity. Always so negative. Always so critical. Always looking down the nose at everybody. So condescending. No, again, we're having to go by Jesus' values, not our values. Jesus' economy, not our economy. And in our world, we say, oh, bad things shouldn't happen to good people, but this is just bad theology. Because it presupposes good people are in good standing with God because of their good works, and that is just patently false. Yet the Pharisees promoted this idea that if you were doing right, all would be right. If you were doing wrong, you would have ill in your life. So, catch it. The crowd listening to Jesus, when they hear, "Blessed are the poor," they're like, "Blessed and poor?" We've been taught that if somebody is physically impaired, it's because of God. He judged them. He did this to them. That's why they have what they have. Wait, I lost a loved one in my life? Yeah, because God is judging you for what you've done, wrong or bad. Oh, wait, you don't have any money to take care of your kids' food? Well, that's because God is acting out against you for who you are and what you have done. And so they are at this culture collide moment, this world colliding moment, where they are taught one thing and Jesus is coming in saying, that's not how I operate. That's not how my kingdom functions. Blessed are the poor. Matthew would say poor in spirit. So it makes us ask another question. Is Jesus being cruel here? It could be interpreted that way, right? Blessed are the poor. Is it almost like Jesus is saying to them in their ears, hey, it's better to be poor than rich? Well, of course, we'd say no. Such an idea seems completely heartless and illogical. If you've ever had the misfortune to see impoverishment, let's just say here, even in our own American context, you would be foolish to walk in and act like they got the good life. There were several times as a chaplain in California with a volunteer chaplain position I had that I would end up in some apartment along the way. And in like a one-bedroom apartment, it wasn't unusual to have at least three generations living in a one-bedroom apartment. The most I ever saw was 14 people in a one-bedroom apartment. Well, the place was packed, and it was a squalor, and it was filthy, and it was malnourished. All the inhabitants were malnourished. Guess what I didn't do? I didn't walk in and say, "You lucky dogs. I envy you. I'm stuck in like a 3 1/2, and you guys are living the high life here in this low rent Section 8 apartment with 14 people. Oh man, you have no idea how good you have it." If I had done that as a chaplain, you know how long I would have been a chaplain? Not very long. That's perverse. That's weird. That's backwards. That can't be what Jesus is saying here, and certainly it's not. Another consideration we must dismiss is this. Is Jesus saying this broadly? Believe it or not, there's a section of people who profess to follow Christ who would not theologically follow Christ, who say, see, Jesus here is a social worker, saying, blessed are the poor, because universally God will help them and accept them as if he's come here to change their financial situation and status only. Well, it doesn't take much of a thought process to recognize. If we think Jesus is referencing only their socioeconomic status, that's very self-centered and, again, very frail and foolish. That kind of idea would say, you're poor, therefore you're blessed and will be blessed by God for being poor no matter the reason. Well, that, again, is very foolish. All these ideas are at odds and radically different than what Jesus is presenting here. When Jesus says, blessed be the poor, and blessed are the poor in spirit, he's defining it by his rule, he's defining it by his reign, he's defining it by what he says is right. He sets the rules. It's his kingdom. Poor in spirit here doesn't mean somebody who appears defeated outwardly, or somebody who has pitifully low self-esteem, as it were, or somebody who's always upset about what they can't get done, or knows they just can't get stuff done, or they want to get done, or they're shy and quiet and just backwards individuals. No. To be poor in spirit is the opposite of pride. Pride says what? I can do it. Pride says what? I have self-confidence about the matter. Pride says what? I'm sufficient in the matter. I can do anything I set my mind to. I can do what is needed by my own ability. And Jesus says, those people don't have a place in my kingdom. The poor in spirit do. Those who are aware, they have an inward sense, an understanding, a clarity that they have no ability to change their status or standing with God of their own ability. They are helpless. They are unable. They are in a dependent position. It's almost like when you have a little kid or a grandkid trying to do something they can't do, and what do they just finally turn and say? Help. I can't do it, right? I can't. I'm trying to tie my shoe. I can't do it. I'm trying to reach this doorknob. I can't do it. I'm trying to reach whatever. I'm trying to open whatever. I can't do it. I need help. Jesus here is calling us to be poor in spirit, and that is the humility that comes from a genuine sense of dependence, of neediness, of reliance on God. To be poor in spirit is reference to one's spiritual state before Jesus. That you recognize you have nothing to offer and you are in need of everything. You recognize your status, and you receive God's solution that grants you admission into the kingdom of heaven. So then ask the question, if I am not being told that if I'm just poor, God blesses me, if I'm not being told that my blessing is going to be by what I think blessing will be, if I'm being told that I have to be poor in spirit, which means a dependence upon who God is and what he has declared about me and him and being with him forever, then what does it mean to be poor in spirit and have a spot or an entrance in to the kingdom of heaven? Remember, who is Jesus speaking to here? He's speaking to a primarily, if not entirely, Jewish audience. That's the context. They believe they're awaiting their Messiah who will come and deliver them as a nation. From Rome, their oppressors, yes. From the false religious crowd who is oppressive in their lives, absolutely. So they're waiting on this Messiah who will free them from all foreign powers and reestablish them as a political and religious center upon the earth. They'll get to be all that they hoped God would make them to be. That is what the Old Testament talks about as the kingdom of heaven. The Messiah's reign on earth in accordance with his eternal desire being in place. So get it. The kingdom of heaven is when Jesus will reign, and he will reign clearly, and he will reign thoroughly, and people will be subject to that reign according to his dictation. This is the kingdom of heaven. And in that kingdom, he reigns with justice, prosperity, harmony, and blessings flow where he takes over. So according to Jesus, this is what's available. You can know you have a spot in the kingdom of heaven, his reign, his rule. But really, the kingdom of heaven is indicative throughout the New Testament as well, beyond the literal reign, of what it's like in his spiritual jurisdiction. In Romans, Paul talks about what the kingdom of God is like. He talks about it being peace, joy, and love in the Holy Ghost. There is a great opportunity now and later, now temporarily, and yes, forever, to be with Jesus and enjoy what it's like to live with him. To know what the blessings are, to have his reign and rule in and through your life. But here's the entrance for you, friend. It's to the poor in spirit. This flies in the face of what the average Jewish hearer then would have understood or expected or thought. They would have seen those who are poor as unworthy and damned sinners. They would have seen themselves as not dependent, but deserving because they're Jewish after all. We're the covenant nation. We are owed this from God even. But Jesus says that's not how it works. It's for those who are poor in spirit. Not those who are economically oppressed. Not those who are socially oppressed. Not those who are politically oppressed. No. Those who recognize they are spiritually oppressed by sin and need a deliverance, a salvation from Jesus and him alone. That's what gives you entrance into the kingdom. It's not based on some characteristic of this realm. Listen, whatever your ethnicity is, that's beautiful because God created it, but it doesn't punch your ticket, friend, nor does it bar you either. Doesn't matter your socioeconomic status. That's not punching your ticket. It's not barring you either necessarily. Your health situation, your living condition, your education, your religious affiliation, none of those are punching your ticket, yet none of those have to stand in your way either from entering Jesus' kingdom. Why? Because entrance into Jesus' kingdom, it's based upon one's recognition that they're not even eligible for it and require assistance. Have you ever had one of those moments where you didn't have the credentials or you didn't have the pass or you didn't have the finances or whatever it was, and it either was keeping you out of first class or not getting you into a line or not making you have to avoid a wait, and then you know somebody and they get you in? I was flying back from Egypt last year with President Mountain, who's the president of Boston Baptist College, and all the other people had gotten seated. But guess what? The airline had the ability to bump three of us to first class. You know what? I was one of those people. And I walked up there basking in it, sat down, I got my hot towel. Yes, I did. I enjoyed a better meal than other students had. Yes, I did. Did I get a sleepy mask? Yes, I did. Did I get a warm blanket? Yes, I did. And on I could go. But I didn't pay for a first class ticket. And the only reason I got any of that was not because they were like, oh, Paul Norton's on this plane. Quick, come on. They didn't do any of that. I was with President Mountain, who had whatever it was that got it for me. You know what? I was along for the ride and just said thank you. Thank you very much. And I slept like a baby. You and I aren't eligible for the kingdom. Me being a pastor doesn't make me eligible for the kingdom. You coming to church doesn't make you eligible. Your Christian grandmom, your deacon dad, none of that makes you eligible for the kingdom. Well, I was baptized as a kid. Still not eligible for the kingdom. The only people who end up in the kingdom are those who recognize their need of assistance to get into the kingdom. The kind of assistance that a poor person in our realm would require to meet their needs is exactly the position you and I find ourselves in the spiritual realm, as unable to change anything about it. Nothing we can do can change that. Nothing we can do can earn our way into it or change our situation about it. We need deliverance from something we're incapable of delivering ourselves from, and something we cannot become wealthy enough to get into in that realm. He said, this is the message of the Bible. The message throughout the Old Testament was what? Mankind made the choice to say, we'll go our own way, God. We're independent. We'll take care of this. And yeah, we're not outright denying you, but we're going to, you know, find a better middle ground. Instead of fully dependent, independent-ish is what we're going to do. And so Adam and Eve thrust all of humanity into sin. And ever since then, we have been alienated from God. He is our only source of deliverance. And so all throughout the Old Testament, what were they doing? Looking and waiting for a Messiah that would come, who would live and die in their place as the substitute for sin that was needed that they couldn't provide on their own. And he would not only provide the substitute for sin, he would welcome them into his kingdom based on his work and not what they could try to do, as that was failing and awful. So God would right the wrongs around us and craft a path for us. He'd deliver us from our greatest issue, not an external foe, but the constant internal one being a sinner. You're guilty. Now, that's not the message that really sounds good or is appetizing or appeasing to us as human beings. Nobody wants to think that they are errant and unrighteous and guilty. We like to think of ourselves as pretty good, just having bad days occasionally. But that's not the message of the Bible. You aren't a pretty good person that God is just going to have to do a little bit to save. You deserve damnation forever because of who you are. Know who I am, like my personality type? No. Who you are spiritually as an enemy of God. Well, I don't hate him that much. Nothing you have done can undo what you are by nature, which is, in his realm, a sinner. The internal longings you have that I have, the actions we choose to serve ourselves, the quickness we have to interpret others as doing wrong against us and as they owe us, all of these things and more are evidence of your alienation from God. You know what it is even to try to change that. Maybe you came to a point where you realized, well, I am a person who struggles, so I'm just going to try to do better. And how long did that last? And how well did you do? We both know it wasn't very long in your actions or your motives. No matter what you've tried, you're never going to be pretty good in God's eyes, even if you think you are in man's eyes, even if they tell you you are. In God's eyes, it's much worse. Romans tells it like this: when we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. We were yet his enemies, he says in another passage. We are people who consistently, from our inside out, choose that which is offensive to God. And we're not just that, we are actively against God in that he views us as enemies to him, his holy agenda for eternity. We are his enemies. So I'm never going to be good enough. He's holy, he's righteous, and I'm just simply a prideful man. In our spirit before God, what has to change is me going from I can, or I can mostly, or I'm doing enough, or I'm doing decent, to I can't, I never could, I'm never going to be able to. I need Jesus's intervention. You have to have an end to your self-sufficiency and an acceptance of what Jesus has said before the blessed life is ever going to be recognized. You must truly recognize your total dependence upon God. That's why the New Testament authors reference it as an act of love and a gift from Jesus. A gift is nothing that's earned, it's only received. For this blessed life of a follower, it continues in the same way. If you want to know what it is to become a follower, the entrance is through the poor in spirit understanding. I need Jesus to intervene on my behalf and forgive me and deliver me and save me from what I rightfully have coming my way, which is judgment. That's the only way I'm getting into the kingdom. That's the only way I'm having a blessed life. But friends, catch this. That dynamic doesn't stop once you receive salvation. You may receive full pardon and full deliverance and full access, but the enjoyment of that access continues in the same way, poor in spirit. James would say it like this: God resists the proud, but what does he do? Give grace to the humble. When he says he resists, it's almost this idea of two hands and pushing. There's an active resistance against you and I when we decide we're going to default back into pride mode. We're going to do what we can, do what we ought, do what we want to do. The blessed life for a follower is stymied by that. Now, friends, we hear this, and not only in regards to salvation is it difficult to embrace and accept that you got nothing, you need everything from Jesus, but if we're not careful, we can say yes to this, absolutely. Absolutely, I needed his deliverance and forgiveness. And then having received that, knowing we're going to be with him forever, we can errantly and sadly start to have our daily function just like it was before we were saved, before we were his followers, a little bit too dependent on our own, a little too independent of his authority and care in and through our lives. The follower has called to reject the ungodly philosophy around them. What does that sound like? Know what you want and go for it. I gotta have ambition. Nobody got anywhere in this world being poor in spirit, Pastor. Nobody got a promotion being poor in spirit. Nobody had what they wanted being poor in spirit. Nobody got the marriage life they want or the spouse they want or the kids they want being poor in spirit. No, my friend. I've got to push. I've got to shove. I've got to cheat. I've got to lie. I've got to deceive. I've got to do whatever it is. I've got to promote myself and exalt myself to get where I've got to go. I've got to set my mind to it, and it's just going to happen. Good is going to come my way. I want to have it all. I should have it all. I'm going to make sure I get this. I'm going to make sure I get that. And we push and push and push for the recognition we think we deserve, the rewards we think we're owed. And the whole time, the one who delivered us is saying, that's not the way my kingdom works. That's not the way my followers live. Friends, the greatest testimony you have of the gospel changing you is the evidence or fruit through you while you live his kingdom here on earth. Well, why would I live poor in spirit at work? Why would I have this humility and dependence? Why would I have this readiness and quickness to link my life to Jesus verbally, to link my enjoyment, to try to help others get linked up to Jesus? Why would I do that if I know it's going to cost me a promotion? Because you're not living for a promotion. You're living for Jesus. It's his rule. It's his reign that is crucial, critical, vital, and frankly, friend, most valuable. Catch that. Most valuable. And our culture has it all wrong, and we need retraining from the inside out. And what is right and what is wrong? What does Jesus' reign spiritually look like in and through my life trapped here in time? What does it look like in how I interact with other people? How does it look like in how I shape my marriage? How does it look like in the way I parent my kids eternally? What does it look like with what I do with God's money and God's time and God's material possessions he's giving me? All that, my friends, and way more, comes under the jurisdiction of Jesus Christ. And those don't become snares of frustration and discontentment and disillusionment. They become avenues to enjoy what? What he said, blessed are. See, the blessed life, friend, it begins here. It may be contrary to our outlook, but it is possible because of the forgiveness Jesus offers. It may be contrary to what we think will procure a blessed life, but it's possible because we're freed from a bad definition by being trapped in time, space, and tainted by sin. On the plane ride, I usually enjoy reading a book I read or reread every year, year and a half or two. It's kind of on the history of missions. It starts all the way back at Jerusalem and goes up to relatively modern day in Irian Jaya. And I'm always convicted, challenged, and embarrassed by what I read in that book about followers of Jesus long before us. Not in a guilt and shaming way, but just in a way that reminds me I'm way too prone to live for this realm I read about men and women who said goodbye to their parents and never saw them this side of heaven again. Why? Because of the gospel imperative to go. I read of sons and daughters who watch their parents live very depressing lives economically, be belittled by unbelievers, sometimes face opposition from other believers, and live their entire upbringing that way for the gospel to a people group that seemed to not want them there. I read of parents burying their kids on the mission field because of the lack of medical care where they are and were. I read of people being called away by institutions and organizations and them having to say, you know what? No, we're staying for the gospel here because there are no other people. People born in boats, eventually planes, and being willing to sacrifice and upend all the American dream, all the British dream that they would have had in those time periods and say yes to the gospel. Did they have struggles? You better believe it. Were there times they wish they hadn't done it? I imagine. Some of them record that in their journals. But they recognize something. Blessings aren't where we think they are. Blessings are with Jesus, who he is, where he rules, and what he says they are. And they were willing to be dependent upon him and his instruction and his clarity about what's it like where he rules. My challenge to you and I this morning is this. That's where it starts, and that's how it must proceed to be his follower. That's where the blessings are, friend. That's where the enjoyment is. That's what you were designed to have and go forward in. But the question has to come back to you and I. Are we going to accept the entrance? The entrance is what? Poor in spirit. You may be here today as a man or a woman, young or old, and you're familiar maybe with church or you're not. You've heard about Jesus or this is your first time. Here's what I want to ask you to do. Would you be willing to ask yourself the difficult question, am I relying on Jesus for my forgiveness and deliverance from what I rightly deserve forever? Maybe I could ask you like this, why aren't you going to go to hell today? Whatever your first answer is your answer. If today that answer wasn't because I know in my neediness and my dependence, I put my trust in Jesus alone. He alone to forgive and change and save me. If that's not your response or answer, if there was even a hint of, I'm a pretty good person. If there was this, I got the baptism thing. If there was this, you know, I'm religious. If there's this, well, I'm a good person overall. If there's this, I give money sometimes to people who need it on the street. That's not deliverance from sin, friend. I would ask if you'd be willing to start the conversation today about Jesus. In a second, we're going to have what we call an invitation. It's where we invite you to respond to what you've heard. And there are going to be people in the foyer there ready to help start that conversation, answer your questions. We'll take as long as you want to today. We can schedule a follow-up. Whatever is needed, we want you to hear great news about the message of Jesus Christ and have your questions answered. Then I want to speak to us as followers. Right now, is there a daily routine, a habit, a situation, a relationship that is being hindered because of our lack of willingness to accept what Jesus has said about being poor in spirit? Is that characterizing your walk with Jesus on a consistent basis? Your dependency, not only for salvation, but this is the function of his kingdom, a reliance and dependency. Well, how can we know that? Well, Jesus said this in John 15. I'm the vine, you're the branches, and without me you can do nothing. Along the way, sometimes we read our Bible, which is a good thing. We go to church, that's a good thing. We use our gifts, that's a right thing. We give to the gospel, that's a good thing. We take time to pray, that's a good thing. We try to be intentional in our relationships, that's a good thing. But none of those reduce or eliminate the need for daily what? Poor in spirit dependency. My encouragement is, if there's a relationship, a situation, an ideology, some scenario that you're struggling to connect those two, realize Jesus, his care, his guidance, his work, his blessings are fully expressed through the conduits he's made. And the first conduit is what? Are the poor in spirit. If there is someone in some way, in some manner, that he's trying to upend that today in your thought process, let him. It may be difficult. It may be painful. It may come with some apologies needed. It may come with forgiveness being sought. It may come with a change in your philosophy towards someone or something. It may change your work environment even. But today Jesus has said, blessed are the poor in spirit. And there is no secondary way, not only for salvation, but for enjoyment as being his follower. Would you stand with me this morning? I want you to take a moment with your heads bowed to reflect on what God has been stirring in your life through the word that was sung and through the word that was preached. And if you're here and you want to talk about Jesus, walk right out right now. We're not going to stop you. Nobody's going to embarrass you. I want to just ask you to be bold and take that first step. Doesn't matter if you're young or old, been here a long time, never been here before. Take that first bold step. And then, Christian, I'm going to ask, as the instruments play, take time. Bow where you're at. If you want me to pray with you, I'm going to turn my mic off and go to the front row. Be glad to pray with you. But what is God stirring in your heart about being poor in spirit?